Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have on the show with us today Dr. Rob Sheldon, who received his PhD in physics from the University of Maryland, and after appointments at the University of Bern in Switzerland, as well as Boston University and the University of Alabama Huntsville, he's currently consulting with NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. Dr. Sheldon has done some wonderful writing for us on evolution news and views, talking about the history of cosmological thought, as well as some recent discoveries that support the Big Bang and have implications for the origin of the universe. So, Dr. Sheldon, thank you so much for coming on the show with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Casey. It's a pleasure.
Well, I want to first talk to you about some of the writing you've done on evolution news and views, talking about sort of the history of cosmological thought and how we've gone from belief in an eternal universe to today, where we believe in a finite universe and a Big Bang, a beginning to the universe. And I really enjoyed reading your article because it helped, I think, clarify the way that thought has shifted over the years. So I want to start off just talking about the ancients and what did they believe about the origin of the universe. They tried to explain the universe as a static entity that was infinite in its extent and infinite in time. So why did the ancients see the universe as a static universe that was infinite in size and infinite in time?
Well, that's a good question, Casey. And I think we live here in the 21st century and think that we know so much more than everybody who lived before us. I think C.S. Lewis called that chronological snobbery. But the Greeks were very good astronomers. They were very good scientists. They were putting together a view of the world. And if you speak to any philosopher, he will tell you that we've been replaying the whole Aristotle versus Plato argument for the past 2,000 years. And the same thing is really true of science, of the foundations of science. You know, why is the universe the way it is? What is it made out of? How come it's the way we see it? And these questions that get asked in the philosophy department were in Aristotle's book that came after his book on science or after his book on physics. And so they refer to it as metaphysics. But metaphysics is, the Greeks were looking at what is the reason that the universe has this shape and form and that we live in it. And for the Greeks, I guess they felt that their gods were a little bit small. At the time of Aristotle, they were sort of leaving behind their polytheism and looking for a god who was big enough to explain the universe that they saw. But nevertheless, their god was always somebody that lived within the universe. He didn't create the whole universe. And so their god, being a small god, had to form or shape or fashion the materials around him to explain where humans come from, to throw thunderbolts or create thunderstorms. And so this idea was that the matter that the gods use or shape was eternal. It was already there. It was chaotic and unformed, but it was ready to be used. So even Plato talks about his creator as being a fashioner of eternal matter. And the debate between Plato and Aristotle was, were those shapes something that was in the mind of God, or are they inherent in the materials of the universe itself? And so Aristotle wanted all these, the way we view it today in physics, wanted all these laws of nature to be inherent in nature itself. So the Greeks were working out, was the laws of nature sufficient to explain where everything came from? Or is there an additional purpose-driven aspect to creation? In that debate between Aristotle and Plato, Democritus is a really important character. He lived roughly the same time as Aristotle and Plato, but he didn't want any gods at all, any person at all to fashion. So he took Aristotle one further and said that the materials are nothing but little atoms bouncing around in the void, and that these atoms are eternal. And they have no beginning, no creator, no creator necessary to make them. They've always been there. You can't destroy them, because even if you destroyed one or two of them, after a long, long time, there wouldn't be any left. So there's no beginning to these atoms, no end to the atoms, and there's no purpose to construct the atoms. There's no messing around in between. And so with Democritus, we get a Greek who really believed that the universe had absolutely no need for a creator, and that all you needed was eternal matter, matter and eternal time. And so those Greeks really felt that to eliminate all aspects of human or purpose-driven or God, creator, all you needed was eternal time, eternal matter and indestructibility. Did I answer your question, Casey?
That's very helpful, Dr. Sheldon. And of course, that eternal view of the universe has changed radically, especially in the last 100 years or so. But of course, even before the Big Bang, which we'll get into real soon here, even before the Big Bang theory came on the scene, people were already coming up with arguments against an eternal universe. And what was some of the early evidence discovered by science that challenged that ancient static view of an infinite universe? And why did it challenge that view?
Well, the conundrums of the infinite time and infinite space are that if everything is infinite, for example, let's just take stars, if the stars are infinite, then when we look at the night sky, if we look far enough, we should see a star somewhere. And that means that instead of just seeing a few stars in the sky, we should see a white sky just packed completely with stars. Well, that paradox was given in the 1700s, but there are several other paradoxes that we ran into. When Newton started to say, well, there's this inverse force of gravity that attracts the stars together, then the question is, well, if we wait an infinitely long time, shouldn't all the stars have clumped together? And so what keeps the stars from falling? And these kinds of questions led to a series of sort of compromises. One compromise was that, well, there's this rigid material like a crystalline sphere that holds the stars in place so that they don't fall, and that perhaps there's dust between the stars that absorbs some of the starlight so that behind these stars we can't see the most distant ones because they fade away. And yet the more we learn about science, the more these infinities don't seem to work out. If the dust is in between the stars and it's absorbing the starlight, then it will eventually get hot and glow white as well. That's what thermodynamics tells us. So none of these solutions seem to really explain this eternity problem. They just made it more complicated. And so you started to get a feeling that the universe was getting very, very complicated just to maintain eternal space and eternal time. You know, I'm jumping ahead to the Middle Ages, but if you go back to 400 AD, Augustine saw in Genesis that God was outside the universe and created everything in it. And so for Augustine, this meant that God was an ex nihilo creator who created without any need for a matter of eternal space or eternal time. And so that became the two conflicting worldviews, the idea that the eternal space and time didn't require a creator, and the idea that if you had a creator, he created ex nihilo.
So, Dr. Sheldon, what was the contribution of Lemaître, who, of course, was a monk, and I know that he had some very deep religious views. How did his religious viewpoints help inspire his work and the contributions that he made to cosmology?
To understand Lemaître, I need to explain Einstein. Einstein was trying to understand gravity, and he came up with the idea that there isn't a mysterious attraction between two bodies the way Newton described it, but rather when you put a massive body in space, it bends space-time down. So it becomes a dip or a dimple. If you think of space-time as being like a rubber sheet on top of a drum head, if you put something heavy on that drum head, it will make a big dimple, and then all little ball bearings will roll towards it. And so Einstein defined gravity as a warping of space-time itself. And now, not only do the stars clump together, but the space-time clumps together. And this caused a real problem for Einstein. He didn't know how to solve it. And he put his equations out there in 1917. And Lemaître was a physicist, Belgian monk, and he started to look at Einstein's equations and said, you know, if we believe, Augustine, that God created the universe out of nothing, and if we look at Einstein's equations, we can see how Einstein's equations, having everything clumped together, can be turned upside down and everything spreading apart. And so he said, we can actually find a beginning of the universe by looking at Einstein's equations and solving them for a time when everything was together. Lemaître also knew about a Slipher. Slipher was an astronomer in America who had measured the light coming from distant galaxies and had shown that it was redder than it should be. And he attributed this reddening to the fact it was moving away from us. and we call it the Doppler shift. If you've ever listened to a car race, that as a car approaches the microphone, it has a high-pitched motor, and as it leaves, it goes low pitch. And so you all know that sound, and that's the Doppler shift. So when it's leaving you, it shifts down, and that makes the light redder. And so Slipher said, all these galaxies are coming away from us. So Lemaître looked, and he said, we can find a solution to Einstein's equations that show the universe had a beginning, and that at that beginning, all of these galaxies started to move apart. And Lemaître himself describes it as a cosmic egg, which sounds a bit odd. But if you look at Genesis 1, verse 2, it says the Holy Spirit broods over the face of the waters. And the word brood is like a bird sitting on its eggs. And so I think Lemaître really was inspired by Genesis when he found that solution to Einstein's equation for an expanding universe.
So is it correct to say that Lemaître, though he was a monk, in some ways was the father of modern cosmology?
Lemaître gets, unfortunately, way too little credit for what he did. Most of his work is attributed to an American astronomer, Edwin Hubble. And so when we built the big telescope in space, we called it the Hubble Space Telescope. And the reason we called it that is because with that big piece of glass in space, we can see farther than we've ever seen with telescopes on the ground. And one of the first things the Hubble Space Telescope did is it found a patch of black sky without any stars, and it stared at it for like 2 or 3 weeks and collected all the light. And when all those photons were registered, we saw in that black patch of sky, the most distant galaxies in the universe. We were staring way, way out into the past to see those galaxies. And so we viewed the Hubble Space Telescope as our telescope to see the beginning of the universe. And it should have been named the Lemaître Space Telescope, because Lemaître published all of those works 2 years before Hubble. And he even calculated that if you work backwards in time, the speed of the galaxies, when you reverse them, come back together. He calculated the beginning of the universe was about 10 billion years ago. And so all of this work had been done by Lemaître, and yet he doesn't get any of the credit for it. It's a pity. I sort of feel that sometimes you see that the scientists who are the most religious get the least credit.
Well, Dr. Sheldon, unfortunately, I think we're running out of time for the first part of this podcast. So stay tuned for more with Dr. Rob Sheldon on ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.